We're a small group today, so we can be very informal. And let's talk about our lives and see which way we're going. Because as you get on with the vicissitudes of life, you begin to see that there's no hope for the future.
Thank you very much.
How long does one have to practice before you just
said? I'm like the new guy who came here last week.
Which guy? That other guy? Yeah.
Ed or
the psychologist guy? The blonde guy?
Yeah,
what happened?
Well, he's giving up all hope.
Oh, yeah. I'm giving up on everything. I'm just staying at home.
Well, that's what I'm experiencing. You know, whereas he thinks it's okay, I really don't know if it's okay or not, you know.
It doesn't really make any difference. For who says you have to work from 9 to 5 every day?
Yeah.
Where is it written you have to do that? The rule to go by is this. As long as you do not impose on anybody else, do what you like.
As long as you what?
Do not impose.
On anyone else. I don't look for anything. I mean, I don't... If there's not an explicit reason for me to get up in the morning, I don't get up. Or I haven't been doing my practice as I usually do.
There are two ways to look at that. One is you can form bad habits from youth. And you just have bad habits. And if you're in the world, that's no good. The other one is when you transcend the world. And then you're your own person. So it doesn't really matter what you do at that stage. But don't use that as license. When I say it doesn't matter what you do, I mean when you transcend the world, you automatically develop loving compassion for all things. You become kind, peaceful, and you're actually an asset to the world. So you do not go around hurting people or taking advantage of people or using people. When I say you do your own thing, I mean you're your own person, you're the self. And the self does not have to abide in the world whatsoever. Because you abide in yourself. And when you abide in the self is the world. For remember, the self is omnipresent. Therefore, when you abide in the self, you abide in the universal. It's the same thing. And since the universal is always gentle kindness, compassion and love, you become an embodiment of those verities all by yourself. That's what I mean when I say you can do whatever you like. I mean after you've transcended, when you become emancipated, then automatically you'll do the right things.
It'd be safe to say that you're not even doing those things.
Exactly.
The universal self.
Exactly.
That you're not even trying to do it.
Well, it's paradoxical because you are the universal.
Right.
So you're doing it, but you're not doing it.
Right.
You're following the Dharma.
It's doing itself, almost.
Mm.
But until you reach that point, I mean, how many people are in that state?
There are some people that are almost there.
Until you reach that state, shouldn't you have some form of discipline?
Yes, you should.
Doesn't that discipline also involve working in the world?
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. It depends. But the word discipline is a good word. You should discipline yourself. For instance, in my life, I get out of bed about 5-6 o'clock. I sit down in a chair for about an hour or two. and then take the dog for a walk and do exercise in the park. Then I go eat breakfast. Then I sit back down in the chair. And it's already 5 o'clock. I just mess around until it's time to go to bed. Who said that I was going to be late?
I am late.
No, you're not.
But only by
Hi. Therefore, it's good to be disciplined before emancipation. Otherwise, you can go to hell. Really, you let your body run amok. And one day you'll do this, the next day you'll do that, and you'll become discouraged and disgusted with yourself.
What was the question?
Ask Sam, what was the question?
No, there was no question.
So you got to be careful with yourself. As I said, you can develop bad habits. And you think you're free, but it's not freedom at all, just bad habits. You have to be true to yourself. Now, it comes to my attention that when we look at the world, what do we see? If you look at the sky, what do you see? If you look in this room, what do you see? What do you see, Glenn? If you look at this room.
Everything that my mind is projecting.
True. But you see furniture, bed, people. True.
Space.
Ah, that's the answer. That's very good, Jay. That's exactly what I was looking for. That's what I see. I see the space in between the objects. And the objects are a superimposition on space. But space is the key word. You look at the sky, people see the planets, the stars, the moon, the sun. But I see space. And the things are just objects imposed on the space. If it weren't for the space, there wouldn't be any objects. We only see objects because of the space. The space is like the chalkboard. We enjoy the sun, and you enjoy the moon, and you enjoy the stars. But if you did not have the chalkboard, you would not be able to enjoy those objects. We ignore space, but space is our real nature. That's what we're made out of, space. If you tear yourself apart and go down to your atoms, think of the space in between. We're all made of space. When you dig a hole in the ground, you take out the dirt. What have you got? Space. When you put the dirt back into the hole, what happened to the space? Did it go away? What happened to the space? Exactly. It didn't go anywhere. The space permeates all of life, so to speak. Therefore, your real nature is space. You are space. And the forms come and go. The secret is to identify with the space, not with the form. Forms come and forms go, but space is the reality.
So are we talking about transparency rather than something or nothing?
We're talking about nothing.
No, nothing. Okay.
Space is no thing. And your real nature is no thing.
Well, is space no thing? Because in my brief career of learning a lot, I learned that air is a thing. I mean, you can hit it hard, and it has wet currents and all that kind of stuff. Are you talking about space the same as air?
Did you learn how to fly? Do you wave your hands?
I only logged a few hours that was in a plane. But what I'm saying is, are you referring to air as space? Because air is a thing.
I'm referring to the space beyond the air. The air is not in position in space. But true space is the substratum of all existence. You can say the self is space.
The self is space?
The self is space. That's what I mean when I say you're omnipresent. When I use the term omnipresent, you usually think that you're all things. But the truth about that is you're nothing. You're nothing. That's omnipresent. And because you're nothing, you're everything. That's what I mean when I say, all this is the self and I am that. Everything is the self. And I am is that. So everything is space. Think about that.
Last satsang, when you were talking about the body and how we may think of ourselves dwelling in the bodies, the spirit dwells in the temple of the body, where you said that we are not the self in the body, but we are the self as the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was particularly, what can I say, looking at it from a totally different perspective. I thought that cleared things up a lot, and what you're saying about space now in a similar light is doing the same thing. And also when we were talking about the chair, physical objects, animate and inanimate objects, and how from a relative point of view there are inanimate and inanimate objects, as if there is a sentient body and then insentient objects. But from an absolute point of view, there's only oneness, and there's no difference between sentient and insentient.
Exactly.
So sentient and insentient.
With relative terms.
So for me that was kind of a new outlook, because I was always accustomed to thinking, well, there's a difference between something that's alive, something that isn't. And I was always usually accustomed to thinking that the self is inside the body. And now what you're saying about space kind of confirms these other two outlooks, you know.
And also, that's what I mean when I say the body doesn't really exist. Space exists.
That's the point.
The body is an appearance, but it doesn't exist.
Robert, you once said, in addition, now today you said that you see space. You once said you could see the glue that connected all things. Is that
the space?
The same thing.
Same thing.
Is that what you're talking about?
The glue that connects.
Yeah, because you gave this wonderful analogy would be if there was like this giant creature and it was looking down on our universe, it might see it as a solid mass in the same way that we see the table or the chair or whatever. But if you broke it down into the planets, the atoms would be the equivalent of planets, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And what you saw was what was in between, which I think now I understand you meant to mean the interconnectedness.
Yes.
When you said glue, because glue and space seem kind of different from each other, but not when you think of it just being the essence.
That's a word to make you understand what it means instead of space. We use glue because everybody relates to glue.
Yeah, we're all glue sniffers.
That's where space comes in.
About this particular fire.
That the, you said that the self is the body, and not just the self that lives within the body.
You weren't here then.
No, I wasn't here.
Oh, well, see, that was, I thought that was a particularly salient point, and Robert basically gave a satsang on it. Maybe you'd like to say more.
No, go ahead, Tom.
Well, it's, the point of it is that we are so accustomed to thinking of the soul in a body, and Gail once brought that up. And Robert was trying to bring that point out. And then the last satsang, he brought the point out more without even there being a question. That I guess the point was when Robert gave out the mantra, who am I? I am he. I am not the body. People weren't quite understanding what I am not the body is. When he says that we are not the body, he does not mean that we are a soul or the self, which we call the self, dwelling within the body. We are not the self within the body because that denotes duality. And of course, Advaita is non-duality. He says it's not that we are the self in the body, but we are the self as the body. In other words, the self being the screen, the body being the picture. The screen is reality. The picture is not the reality. The picture comes and goes. The body comes and goes. The screen remains the same. That is the non-duality, is the oneness. Not a soul within a body that transmigrates. That's again, duality. He's trying to bring us out of that. And it's a lot in the teachings, even in Ramana's teachings, that you reincarnate. And to think about that, continually think about it, kind of draws you back into duality. And I think the thing is, even get away from that concept. And to do that, as Robert said, is to think of the self as the body, as the universe, but not in it, as it. The self is a projection as the body at this time. And when we were talking about animate and inanimate objects, I thought that was on a similar vein, because from a dualistic perspective, there are levels. And we say, well, there's animate and there's inanimate. And from that perspective, it's true. But from a non-dual level, there's no difference between a sentient being and an insentient object. And if you think about that, saying, well, I'm the same as this desk or chair, that makes you think. See, and it brings home the same point.
Good.
And that point is looking at it in terms of duality, well, there's sentience and insentience, yet still in that point of duality. But if you see everything as consciousness, not just your body, but everything as consciousness, then you get a better understanding of what the self is.
Okay, let me respond to you. I agree absolutely with everything you said, and I believe that for a long time. I have no problem with that. But it seems to me that going on from that point, this implies that the body or the physical world, granted its phenomenal nature, granted its transitory nature, still, as you say, is the self, is the true self, and therefore the whole physical world can be viewed with joy and delight and as something of great importance.
As long as
the thought is kept in mind, it is evanescent, it is transitory.
As long as you believe you are the body, you have a completely different viewpoint about the world. But as soon as you realize that you're not the body, things seem entirely different.
But see, the conflict here that I see, I understand, and I think it's very well put, what you said, Glenn, and what you added. But then when you go to the next step, which is that the body is all part of an illusion, how can you say that the self is the body and everything else? Aren't you saying then that the self is illusory?
Well, that's what I just said. The self that you see when you believe you are the body, you're seeing a different self.
But the big self, or the self with the capital S, is not.
The real self is not the body as it appears, but it's the body as the self.
So the real self doesn't see itself because there's nothing to see.
The real self is self-contained.
It's self-contained, right? So there's nothing to see.
So it sees itself.
Or it sees itself. Right.
See, but I don't think, responding to my point, I don't think my point has been adequately responded.
I would say the point is, what you were saying is that understand that the body is the picture.
Right.
And the self is the screen. Yeah. So don't, again, try to identify the picture as the screen. If you're saying, well, then the self is the body. No, that's not the point.
But
the self is the screen as the body. And what Arnold said is, well, okay, samsara and nirvana are one. Basically, that's what you're saying.
Right.
Ultimate reality.
So what you're saying also.
Well, not necessarily. In a sense, yes, but it's even beyond one, because even that idea of one is itself a concept, and it's beyond all concepts. It's not even one. We say it's one so that we can grasp it, but it's beyond one.
Right.
Okay, and when you said, well, therefore, then we can enjoy the world because it's a manifestation of reality, I think what Robert is saying is, well, see, there is no enjoyment, because when there's enjoyment, that's duality again. When Robert talks about bliss, it's not an enjoyment that you compare with happiness, because happiness is connected with joy and sorrow. So it's something beyond a good feeling, a happiness. It's of a different realm. So it's not like we enjoy the world as if we enjoy it, because if we enjoy it, we are also subject to sorrow. So it's beyond that. And it's beyond duality.
But Robert answered, I felt, what you were talking about by saying, as long as you identify with the body, because there's only one of us in this room who doesn't, and that's Robert. So as long as you identify with being in the body, even an iota, I think, yes, you can breathe, you can enjoy the light and the rest of the illusion.
I think so. I think, let's talk about this as using sex as an example. I think that's the best example. I mean, you can go to sex, let's say, with all of the preconceptions of I am this and she or he is that, and we have our responsibilities, and we have within the sexual union and without it, all the various things that are involved with sex, and all of the free expectations, etc., etc. Or one can approach sex, let's say, from more of what is the tantric view. I mean, the exaltation, knowing that there will be, let's say, the ecstasy of sex, and the downturn. There will be, even in that experience, there will be the merging of both positive and negative. But you can also just give yourself over to that that experience without attachment. This would be closer to, it seems to me, to this point that I'm trying to get at, which is, I mean, the enjoyment or the experience of the form life while we're here. And there are those two approaches, it seems to me.
Jeff used to say.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, the experiencing life. He used to say that all the time. And Rob, the last satsang, Robert was talking about the difference between nirvikalpa and sahaj samadhi. And that's what comes to mind right now, because what you're saying is, well, we can merge with it and enjoy it, but in a sense, that's like sahaj samadhi. Sahaj samadhi is something that you would meditate and then you have an experience, but you see, you come out of that experience and then you're the same person again. Whereas sahaj samadhi is a continual experience. You never come out of it.
But while you're waiting for this samadhi,
yeah,
what do you do?
Well,
have sex?
Nothing.
Okay. What
do
you do?
Somebody wrote a book, What to Do Until the Messiah Comes.
Really?
Yeah, there's a book like that.
That's an interesting title.
I mean, Rabbi wrote it, some rabbi. The rabbi that his children were killed, this whole thing. It was pretty popular back in the 70s. But here are the facts. When you tell me your point of view, Arnold, You're speaking from the point of view of a yani, from an ego point of view. And from an ego point of view, what you're saying is fine, no problem. But to get beyond that point of view, there's a completely different realization. Where sex is still enjoyed, only it's not the same. It's totally different. And the difference cannot be explained. Because the whole universe is different to the yani. Everything is different. It's all experiencing within the self. All the experiences I had within the self. Whereas when you're doing from a human point of view, there are two people experiencing. From a yani point of view, there's only one. So the whole thing of the situation is different. You're coming from a different place. And you're speaking from a human point of view. And from a human point of view, every happiness has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But a transcendental point of view, that happiness is forever, eternal. There's no beginning, there's no end. That's what's called the self, or space. That's the difference.
Okay, all right, I can accept that. But let's say, let's use this hypothesis. Let's say I have 10 years ahead of me, and I can have sex and have this ecstasy. Let's say I can have a taste of ecstasy off and on throughout these 10 years on the way to a greater enlightenment. Or let's say I choose a different path of just talking, of which leads to frustration, which leads to hunger of various sorts, which leads to many, many things of that nature. That in the long run may take me further away from my goal than the sexual path.
Nobody's telling me to suppress sex.
Pardon me?
Nobody's telling you to suppress the sex. There's nothing wrong with it. But to understand where you're coming from, what's going on. That's why I say when you know yourself and you know who you are, it's just a different point of view. You're not supposed to give up sex if you don't want to. But as you know, as a human being, when you're finished with sex, you're depleted. And then you wait a little more while and you want more. Then you go looking for more. And it never ends. The depletion, then wanting more. And that's true with every human endeavor. But from a higher point of view, there's no depletion and there's no more. It's just a continuous movement of happiness and joy. That's not ending.
Well, it sounds to me then that it's wiser to suppress the sex really and to maintain the hunger for the eternal experience.
Why give up one for the other? You don't have to do that. You can have both. If you give up sex, you won't get there faster. But it's being rational about what you're doing. Understanding of why you're doing what you're doing. And not getting caught up in something. And saying that's the thing by itself. Variety is fine.
So it's, as always, it's the greater degree of consciousness about every action.
When your consciousness has risen, then your viewpoint always comes from bliss. You can have sex and not have sex, it's okay. But the bliss never leaves you. Because you understand whatever action you take is a cosmic joke. Because it's just like being in a movie where the screen is the reality and the impressions on the screen are fleeting. Therefore the yani takes part in the movie but realizes that he's really the screen. That's all. He doesn't get lost in the movie. Whereas the average person takes the movie seriously, or their part in life that they're playing. They take their part in life seriously.
The movie of life.
The movie of life. They take it seriously. They think that's what it's all about. Because I'm feeling this and I'm feeling that. I've got this emotion, I've got that emotion. I need this, I need that. And we don't realize it's like a movie. And we're the space, or we're the screen. That's right, identification. And when we identify with the screen, we become the screen. And we're emancipated.
Were you here on the time? Because it helped me a lot when Robert, I asked if the self were the screen or the projector. And he said the mind is the projector. And that helped me to distinguish between those two, because for a while I was kind of getting confused between, I thought the self was projecting, but it's not.
The self doesn't have to do anything. The self just is.
Well, that raises something that's been in my mind, a question that's been in my mind that I wanted to ask you to comment on. Isn't it a problem, really, to give these attributes to the self that we have in the past? When you and others say the self is pure love, pure intelligence, pure bliss, yeah, and so forth. I mean, there are some writers who say, you know, nothing whatsoever can be attributed to the self. What would you say about that?
Nothing is love. Nothing is absolute reality. It's the same thing. But those are just words used to describe the state. Otherwise we sit in silence.
And you think of nothing as no thing, which is exactly what it means. That helps.
When I mean nothing, I mean when you do away with everything in your mind, which remains is emptiness. Emptiness is no thing. No thing is bliss, love, pure intelligence. That's no thing.
So we just kind of use these terms to help us
describe nothing.
Even though we know they're not exactly accurate descriptions.
As long as you have to describe something, it's not that at all. But for the sake of talking, we've got an idea what it is. Say about myself is I'm not dependent on any external thing for my happiness. I can be rich or poor, sick or healthy, as far as my body is concerned. I can be here or there, but I'm not dependent on that for happiness or unhappiness.
Are you more, therefore, inclined? Or rather, inclined to do nothing?
Well, the self is nothing.
But so, I mean, would you be more disinclined to be active? Because I know you've said, for example, your family doesn't understand how you can sit for hours looking out the window or something. It seems like that would imply a disinclination for...
It doesn't make any difference.
While still in the body.
It's sort of paradoxical. It doesn't make any difference.
Oh, so you're just as happy sitting at home as you are if you went out?
Yes, the body can go here, it can go there, it can do this, it can do that, and it doesn't have to do anything. But the feelings of joy and happiness are not feelings. They're rather a way, the natural way of life. The reality is always the same.
He's shared that, you know, his family's always trying to get him to do things, as activities, and he just sort of goes along with it or not, because you're really indifferent, right? You're just as happy doing things as not doing things, right?
I can get involved in things and be happy doing that too. But it's like an act.
And it's not something you need, right? You don't need to be...
I don't know, right. It makes no difference where I am. I can be in prison, in a cave, in a mansion, on a boat, in the ocean. all the same.
What if you were in a forest and there was no food?
I wouldn't even think of it.
And then?
I've had an experience when I was in India. But I wouldn't even think of it. I realized that the power that takes care of the trees, that makes them grow leaves and fruits, takes care of this body, whatever it is.
That also seems to come from a realized point of view, because I don't know that anyone still identifying with the body, which all of us Ayanis do to a degree, would have that kind of faith, or would it, or not even faith, knowledge.
Well, it's not even knowledge. That's what I was saying in the beginning. The rules are always different. That's a good point. It's an understanding, like I said before, that all this is the self. Meaning everything, the whole universe is the self. And I am that. So what is there to fear?
Which explains when you said sometimes this path would tend to give people license. Like I remember one student, I won't mention his name, who decided that he had to just do nothing and he kept getting his car keys and stuff. But that was quite beside your point.
Yeah.
It wasn't that he could just become, you know, like stagnant or something.
Why is that element that is happening in my life right now? And part of it could be due to laziness. But if someone calls me and wants me to do something, then I can do that. Otherwise, I don't do it.
Well, that can come from disillusionment. It can come from being on the path for years and nothing happens. So you become discouraged.
Couldn't it be the first vehicle?
Transformation, was that?
But not what you're saying.
Period of change.
Well, you said the vehicle could be the love and desire to be alone, and maybe he is just as happy, or if not more so, to be loved than not. Is that what you were saying?
No.
Well, the fact is that he's still worried about it. So there's still a
lot. Well, I didn't get the sense it's worth.
Because if he was just doing it, maybe in that sense it would be.
No, it's just a
question.
I think part of it is a lazy, bad habit.
To self-observation.
Because I'm not doing much of anything, so I don't need to keep appointments or worry about
that. Well, as we said before, that's okay if you're in an emancipated state. But if you still have feelings, and like you say, you feel that you're doing something wrong, you have a bad habit, then you've got to inquire a little harder and ask yourself, why is this happening? Who's it happening to? Who's going through all this? And you mustn't give up. Too many people give up, you know. For some reason, they have so many books to read. Thousands of books, and everybody's getting enlightened about all these enlightened masters. They say, gee, I gotta, why doesn't it happen to me? I've been going for 2 weeks now, and nothing has happened.
4,000 volumes.
Yeah.
And we become totally discouraged, and we give up everything.
Well, another way might just be to read so much, there's nothing left to think about, so you might be so boggled. That's it.
I've had somebody call me and tell me that. I've read the highest. I've gone to the highest, and what do I do now? So I said, of course, if you've gone to the highest, you wouldn't ask that question. But apparently you just read the books, and you have an intellectual knowledge of the highest. So now you've got to do something about it.
Without experiencing it.
But see, time and space should not disturb you. It makes no difference how long it takes. As I mentioned before, even if you don't make it in this life, you'll be ahead of the game. Nevertheless. So don't think about making it or not making it. Just focus on the self and reality, and everything will take care of itself. And again, we have a tendency of comparing. Compare yourself with no one. You are unique yourself just the way you are. Stay that way and be yourself. Don't working for yourself or anybody else. Don't think you have to become something. There's nothing to become. Just stay the way you are. And you'll be in your natural state. And everything will be okay. But when you start to think, it's like making ripples in the lake. You can't get a clear image of anything. When the lake is motionless, you can see the reflection of the moon, the stars. But when you make ripples, you see nothing. So when your mind makes ripples by thinking, then nothing happens. Confusion, chaos results. When your mind is quiet and clear, you become the self that you've always been.
Now, you don't stop thinking, though, right? I mean, it's not that the thoughts stop altogether.
Thoughts slow down. And they slow down to the extent that you live in the moment with your thoughts. For instance, I'm aware that I'm sitting here right now. That's as far as my thoughts go. But I'm not thinking what's going to happen 10 minutes from now, or what happened a half hour ago. I stay in the moment.
Now, there are like spaces in between thoughts. Is it like that space becomes bigger?
The space is the self.
But it's not that the thoughts stop completely.
No, but it gets bigger, right?
The space between the thoughts get bigger.
The thoughts become slower and the space gets bigger.
And if you concentrate, you can just make it bigger, like in meditation.
When you stop your thoughts, then you're in yourself.
I've noticed several things that when I'm doing self-inquiry and I get to certain states, I find that I can't repeat that. I think, okay, I've been somewhere, I've done something, and then I'll try it the next day, you know, and the next day is just another universe, and then I can't repeat things.
Well, get rid of the notion that you're going to repeat anything.
Well, I mean, that's just an observation. But what I've noticed is also when I was doing self-inquiry, and sometimes I'd focus in on my thoughts, and sometimes there'd be progress, you know, there'd be some kind of progress where I could see the thoughts arise, I could sometimes see the space and see another thought come about. And then at other times, I can't focus in on that, and it's just a succession of thoughts, and I can't see the space in between the thoughts. Sometimes what I would do is just say, well, there's nothing going on, I'm not progressing, and so then I'd just stop sitting and I'd get up. But now I thought, no, that's not it at all, because if that happens all the time, then I won't sit all the time. I'll say, well, there's nothing happening, let me get up. So what I've done now is just stay there and work with that, and then it gets more like what you were saying, observe.
That's right.
So in the first instance I thought that I was observing, and then I'd say, well, there's no observation taking place, so let me get up. Or there's no, you know, there's no, how can I say, there's no experience, there's no, I'm not drawn into myself, and so I would get up. But I find that the fault is in me getting up.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've discovered is it's not just sitting for 20 or 40 minutes, but, you know, maybe sit for 2 hours, an hour, 2 hours. It's a totally different thing, totally different thing.
How do you get past being impatient?
Well, the impatience is what would get me up, because, see, I would watch my mind, and early in the morning the mind is quiet, and I can sit. It's very easy. I could sit an hour, no problem, you know, because the mind is already quiet. In the afternoon when the mind is active, then I'll sit, and all I'll think are all these thoughts, the future, the past, like Robert said, and I'll say, well, I'm not getting anywhere, so then I'll just get up. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm impatient. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying now is no. Don't get up. Don't be impatient.
Or ask yourself, who is impatient?
Who is impatient? But it's even beyond that, because I don't just do... Sometimes, just this morning, I was doing self-inquiry, and I was saying, now, to who do these thoughts come? And what is the origin of these thoughts? And, you know, where do they issue from? And who do they come to? And I kept doing that, and a thought would arise, and then I would say, well, who's thinking about working? Or who's, you know,
and then another thought would arise, and I would always apply it to that thought, and I found I wasn't getting anywhere. So all of a sudden I switched, and I did, I am not this. Rather than, to whom does it come?
Mm.
I said, I am not my work. Mm-hmm. I am not my thoughts. I am not my emotions. I am not my body. And
the fourth principle.
Yes, the fourth, without even thinking of it. I just thought, look, and I'm not getting anywhere with the questions. So I switched to, you know, negation. And it was a totally different feeling. I was saying, well, I could do this for a while. This feels good. Mm-hmm. I was really identifying with not being my emotions, mm-hmm. not being my thoughts.
That's a hard one, to realize that you're not your feelings. Because that means you're not your personality. That's
exactly.
Really, that's an amazing concept.
And that's when we were talking about, we are not the self in the body, we're the self as the body. We are. I just got a real good feeling that saying to myself, I am not my thoughts, because I really believe in my thoughts. I'm not my emotions, because my emotions are so strong I identify with mm-hmm. it. I am not my body, because the body is the only thing I know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was really believing it while I was saying it. I wasn't just.
And that's a hard one to really understand. Because when you say you're not your body, you think that you're a spirit. But you're not a spirit. You just are.
Yeah, that relates to what he referred to when Gail asked about the soul leaving the body. And that's a concept that's
I think many Westerners would take this teaching and turn it into that. Well, I'm not my body, I'm the self in the body.
Right.
And that's a very salient point you brought up last satsang. You spoke to me.
Nigerian spirit.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing, because we're not even the eye.
No, you're not.
Exactly.
Also, another point came to me this morning in meditation. I think I was doing. I do different things. I make things up.
That's good. Be creative.
And I was doing, I am I. I am I. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it came to me what that meant. I mean, it's like I was thinking about it, and I didn't really know what it meant, but, you know, I thought it was a good thing to do. And then it just, the second I just expanded, and I thought, you know, the little I is the big I, you know, and it just felt really good. It was just something that I didn't think about much. I was just kind of doing it, and all of a sudden something dawned on me, you know.
And isn't the next step after that the dissolution of the I?
The I is going to go.
Hence, you know, remember breathing, I am, which I've started to kind of do, like at stoplights, or that sounds silly, but, you know, at moments of, when you're not doing anything, instead of daydreaming, you can sort of breathe the I am, until it almost begins to breathe you, in a sense. I can't quite explain that. But Maharshi also talked about, we talked about this a little bit, instead of breathing the I am, you can also just breathe I.
Exactly.
Which is what you're saying, more or less. And the I mantra, if that, for lack of a better term, will also do away with it, until you realize there's no I at all.
Very similar to what we were saying earlier, is we think all along that I am is the self, as if we are I am, and at the same time we are the self. And that kind of gets back to the idea that there's a self in the body. And the true reality is to know that there is no I am and there is no self. Of course, that blows your mind, because you're saying, we've been coming here all along learning about the self, now you tell me there's no self. But ultimately, that's the real truth, and that even brings it further home.
But I thought the premise, the early premise of this teaching was that the self is all there is. And now are you telling us recently that there is no self either?
The self is all there is. When you're talking about an object, but the natural state is non-self.
So it's beyond non-duality to non-self.
That's beyond non-duality and duality.
It's even beyond non.
So the achievement is not to be the, for lack of, I mean, in finite terms, the higher self, but...
No, there's no higher self. There's no liberation. There's no duality. They're all wrongness.
But even Maharshi refers to the self as being all there is.
For the sake of talking.
Yeah, well, that seems to be one of the only ways we have of communicating.
Could you say that there's no non-duality?
That's what you said.
There's no non-duality. Because non-duality is a concept.
So you can say that there's no duality, but at the same time you can say there's no non-duality.
There's no non-duality.
But then you start to be redundant. You start to not make sense.
Silent.
It gets beyond communication.
Well, it is beyond communication.
In order for me to be able to function with you guys, I've got to use words like that.
It is very helpful.
But my mother must have been self-realized. Because I used to give her a hard time. She'd go, ay.
If she wasn't when she started, she was.
Aye, sir. Yeah. So, in other words, there's no truth. There's no ultimate truth. There's no reality.
Oh, there's no truth. For who is there truth? For whom is there reality? Does God need truth? Does God need reality?
Reality is inherent within itself.
Reality is only... It's only the opposite of non-reality.
Exactly. It's like a mirror upon itself.
Right.
A dualistic notion that doesn't exist.
But non-existence also doesn't
exist. Did you say a non-dualistic notion?
No, a dualistic notion. Anything that is, then there is a part that isn't, and so it's duality, so it's a chicken.
Well, you can't even think so of it. Even to say that it's non-dual is to be dualistic.
Yes.
So non-existence is non-existent too, right?
Of course, because it's a term.
Exactly.
Of course, non-existence is existence as a term, so non-existence isn't non-existence. At the same time, it is.
But what good is this all doing us?
Robert, I wanted to ask.
When
you said that you don't. Your happiness doesn't depend on external things. When you say your happiness, you don't mean happiness in the same way that we understand it.
That's right. But I'm referring to the happiness that you think is happiness.
Right, and I think that's a little misleading because it gets back to the idea of the self in the body again, because when you use the term happiness, we're thinking there's something to be attained, we're thinking it's in the realm of duality, all of these things. But when you say my happiness is not dependent upon external things, you're not using the term happiness in the way that we understand it.
It's very paradoxical, again. For there is something to be attained, and yet there's nothing to be attained. When you attain the self, then you realize you've attained nothing at the same time. And you're radiantly happy all the time. But the happiness is not of this world.
That's what I mean. It's not happiness as we connote with joy and sorrow.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not something we can relate to.
So well, only to the degree that we can.
Happiness to you is bliss, right?
That's right.
And we don't know bliss.
We attain the self and we realize that we have attained nothing, yet we feel like we've attained everything.
That's good. Sometimes people ask me, Robert, if you're so happy all the time, why aren't you laughing all the time?
Well, that's what Ben's saying. It's not happy like we know happiness. Bliss is way beyond anything we can relate to.
Because laughing is for human purposes. And this is beyond humanity.
You could still laugh.
Oh, sure, you can laugh, you can cry.
Right.
You can laugh.
You can even be angry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, which is for that other lady who was sitting there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. You can be anything.
You can be angry.
And this coming from a blissful state.
Well, wouldn't that be your... I guess Jivan Mukti, it would be you, the part of you that still exists in the earth plane that would be angry, it wouldn't...
No, it wouldn't be any part of me at all.
It
would be more for a teaching.
Yeah, that's...
Oh. So you wouldn't feel the emotion of anger?
This is hard to explain even to my family.
Especially to your family.
Of course they hate me because I never get angry at anything.
Yeah.
I just can't get angry. So I gotta put on an act sometimes. I make out I'm angry.
Well, that must have been hard raising your daughters.
Well, I always put on a good act. When they tell me about the injustices in the world, and man is humanity to man, they think I have no feelings.
And what about when you maybe had to discipline them? You had to tell them they were naughty or something.
It affects everything.
So when you get angry, it's only an act.
It is for the purpose of someone else, for someone else. Otherwise, it won't arise.
Yeah, and I appear stupid sometimes because I'm standing there, and everybody's got all kinds of emotions, and I'm just looking around with no emotion.
Because it says, they asked Ramana, what is the sun? You know, what? How do you know a yani? And he said something like, he's always equal posed, and he's always loving, and nothing disturbs him. Yet if an ayani observed a yani as being angry, he would see it from his own perspective.
Hmm.
So that's kind of
a yani's perspective.
Right. So that's, even though a yani can be angry, that's still kind of a paradox.
Well, aren't you saying that the yani can't really be angry?
It's impossible. Because of nothing there to...
It's the expression of anger that can be for the benefit of someone else, and that's why it would arise.
Where does anger come from? The ego.
Right.
Now, there's also, in one of the books, they talked about that the yani doesn't completely destroy all the latent seeds within himself.
It depends.
He can draw upon them when he needs them.
It depends.
Yeah.
That's true. But there are different stages of yanis too.
Right, well that's what I was talking about. In fact, I think it was in Tartora that talked about the three different stages, and that in the first stage the yani seems to go back and forth, but in the second stage the yani is completely free, yet he does not destroy these latent tendencies because he draws upon them when he needs to use them.
When Ramana was asked these questions, when we used to talk about things like that with Ramana, he would say, why are you so concerned with the way Yanni lives? Find out who you are. And never mind what Yanni feels.
Right.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah.
After all, that's also a label.
But, you know, there was kind of getting back to when you said that your happiness isn't determined by external things. I just kind of want to clarify that a little bit, you know, and specifically that the idea of, you know, a yani being happy or what have you. It's not like happiness as we know.
Well, the yani is none of the world, so how can the world make him happy or sad?
Right.
So you look at this situation in Kuwait, for example, at just like a movie.
It is a movie.
Well, especially in our culture, but...
On the screen of love.
I saw this joke recently. I shouldn't... Maybe this is disruptive, but it... Okay. But two guys were sitting and talking, and one said to the other, well, sure, I remember World War II. That's the one that always flickers on TV.
That's our kids are. Everything comes to you so compact. I'm sure if a war breaks out, there'll be families sitting in the living room with popcorn watching.
Oh,
and the commercial will come on and buy this thing.
Yeah, that's what people did. They just watched it on TV. Okay.
Yeah, that
would be nice.
With commercials in between. While people are dying all over the place.
G.I. Joe's.
Of course, there are many people against what's
going down right now.
Sure.
On both sides, right?
Oh, yeah, but I just meant from, again, a Yanni's perspective, that we just like watching any other movie, like going to the theater and seeing it flash across the screen and knowing it wasn't, isn't real.
See,
it sure seems real, that's all.
I know. When I go to a movie, I'm watching the movie, but I'm aware of the screen. Well, everybody else gets lost in the movie.
Well, everybody's aware a little bit.
Nobody thinks about the screen at all.
Unless well, they know that they can get up and leave.
Unless it has a scratch.
Unless you bring it to their attention.
Well, yeah, the screen, the physical screen, but I mean, they know that they're watching the movie and that they know they can get up and leave at any point. Isn't that sort of kind of how a Yanni sees?
Well, and that Yanni sees it this way. They get involved in the action. I forget about the space with the screen.
An Ayani, right.
Yes. Whereas the Yanni is involved in the space with the screen, and the action means nothing. Because acts come and go. Today we're killing Iraq, next week we'll be friends with them. Everything changes. Yeah. Everything changes. The tide always turns. So I get emotional over everything. Will it matter in 50 years?
Historically, I think it will, but philosophically, no.
Historically, it was history for
the ego.
Of course.
And to learn about the relative world. That's ego.
Yeah. How does, or you can also, I won't be offended if you tell me this is an irrelevant question, but how does a Yanni view, say, the nuclear destruction of the Earth?
The same way you use chicken pox.
The same way as chicken pox?
Yeah.
As non-real?
The same way as a scratch.
As non-real? Is that what you mean?
No, how can one thing be real and another thing non-real? Either it's non-real or it's real.
Like a butterfly farting.
That's funny.
Yeah. Either seven.
So a Yanni would not fear nuclear destruction because even he himself or he itself or whatever.
Who dies?
Right.
See, not even a Yanni dies.
Right, because we're all destined to be Yannis at some point, aren't we? Or if not Yannis, at least enlightened. Is there a difference between an enlightened individual or self-realized individual and a Yanni?
Only the difference that you say.
I thought it might be that a Yanni teaches, and maybe, you know, you can have self-realized people who don't. Are there self-realized people who aren't Yannis?
It depends what school you're coming from. But self-realization and Yanni is basically synonymous.
Mm. And Yanni is neither masculine nor feminine. I mean, like
that's
Ananda.
Right.
Yan means wisdom.
That's right.
So Yan is someone who's attained
wisdom.
Yan
means knowledge, yeah. Is there a difference between a Yanni and a sage?
A sage is a Yanni, it's the same thing.
If the sage is realist.
Well.
Or he wouldn't be a sage.
Okay.
Yeah. Unless we'd like to call anybody a sage. It's all words.
But so that's all we seem to have to work with.
Yeah.
In this finite state, you know, they're inadequate.
Well, a real Yanni is like this. In my case, I didn't ask to teach anything.
I know.
I never said I was going to teach. And Yanni doesn't look to be a teacher. Doesn't look for any value, doesn't look for anything. But just expresses himself where he is or she is.
If asked, he responds.
Yeah. Otherwise they do nothing.
Yannis don't care about saving the world or helping people.
That sounds strange but true.
Yet they are compassionate.
Because there's a different understanding. There's no one to be saved since everybody's already saved. No one is ever lost except in your mind.
That's why you don't proselytize, right? Because there's nothing
exactly
to do.
Sure.
So you realize enough, you have to be in the relative world, something, be conscious of the relative world, otherwise you don't even function at all. So the Jnani to be helpful for the Ajnani has enough, is enough aware of the relative world to even express themselves and help others on a relative level.
In a way, but they don't have that kind of feeling. It just happens.
Yeah, but it happens.
It happens.
If presented, it happens.
Because the Jnani has no desires, no ambitions.
To someone who's like an Ahmad, who sometimes that would even happen. I mean, they may be so way out there that they don't even come down enough to relate to someone else.
An Ahmad
who then? Yeah. I mean, someone who's way out who never even comes back, so to speak.
That's possible, yes.
So there's a...
Well, that's called
some of those.
Something else. There's... Jivan Mukti means realized dwelling in the body, and then there's another kind of mukti that means
realize without the body.
Transcendent.
Yeah.
What would that be? Would that mean that someone would leave their body at the time of realization?
They drop their body, yeah.
Does that ever happen in front of anybody?
Oh, yeah. I was with, I think I related this story once before. I was with some Swami called Swami Brahmadanda in Bangalore. And he was about 95 years old. He could hardly move. So his disciples said, "Master, you're needed. You haven't finished your work." So he said, "Well, if you say so, here's what I'm going to do. 2:00 Friday. This young boy will be hit by a car and will be dead. At the same time, I'm going to leave my body. But I will take on the body of this boy." So I was there and I saw it happen. Sure enough, at 2:00, he sat in the lotus position and he stopped breathing. And everybody felt his breath. His pulse, no breath. He was dead. His body was finished. And then we heard a car squeak down the brakes outside. And sure enough, some 20-year-old kid got hit by a car. And somebody felt his pulse and said, "He's dead." And they went to call an ambulance. 5 minutes after that, the kid got up and ran into the jungle, and nobody saw him again.
Wow.
That Ramakrishna's disciple.
No, somebody else.
Oh, really? That's
exactly what happened.
That's
body transference.
Anything is possible.
Did you guys try to find the boy?
They never found him again, I hear.
So he was sort of granted bliss in a way?
Who knows?
That must have been karmic, obviously.
No, it's beyond karma. But you can get to this stage where you do these things if you want to.
Yeah. But I mean, the boy must have been close to enlightenment in other reincarnations.
No, the boy had nothing to do with it. He just checked out and went somewhere else.
Well, we've talked about, except we've talked about that you sort of get credit in various incarnations.
Well, that's true what you're saying, yeah. Du Bois earned that. Du Bois actually earned that privilege of getting killed.
In other incarnations.
Yeah. And he knew it would be Friday at 2 o'clock, so he did the whole thing at Friday, right?
He was way ahead of the game, Du Bois.
I don't think you can presume he knew that it was going to happen.
No, not Du Bois.
Oh,
yeah,
not the original song.
But these are still things in relative terms.
Well, he is the boy.
It's just phenomena. It's all phenomena.
Was it to prove a point?
Well, the Swami Brahmadanda, if he were a real Yanni, he wouldn't have any need to do that. But he was a high yogic master, using all these siddhas.
So in his next incarnation, he might well be a yogi, right? Instead of Swami, right?
Who knows?
But I mean, if he was high, he couldn't lose that. You don't lose
her. Yanis don't go around taking other people's bodies up. There's no need for it.
That's true. That must have been real impressive.
But there are all kinds of stories like that. There was one yogi I know who used to appear in four different places at the same time.
I can imagine seeing you in more than one place.
Well, then we can all do that.
Well, I guess so, but I mean, it really seems that I would know where you were and I would see you. I remember coming to Satsang one time and when we met in the valley, and I was late. Like today, only later. And I thought, oh God, I can't go in, I'll disrupt the class. And then I saw you standing on the portal that, you'd have to understand this apartment complex, but it was built around a pool and it looked sort of like an ashram. And then you walked into the door and I thought, oh, I'm not that late because there are robbers just going in. And when I went in, you were conducting the class. I swear to God or whomever that it happened.
The fan is only pleasure, we'll be on that. May speak for yourself.
But not right on Arnold's neck, he's been unwell. Thank you.
So the important question is, what are we doing with our lives every day? If we're too involved in the world and we take the world too seriously, it means we're using false imagination and we're making real what's false.
Is the third fundamental the concept that, not concept, the reality that everything is egoless or has no cause, is that same as false imagination?
Yes, it is. No thing has a real cause. There really is no ego in anything.
And didn't you explain meaning, that everything is egoless, meaning that it simply appears like in a dream? It doesn't have to evolve, as you said, from reptilian stages. Mm.
Yes.
It just pops on.
Just like a dream.
But longer. In finite times, it seems. The mortal dream is longer, that's all.
That's right. And when we get caught up in the world with its problems, we become worldly. That keeps us back. It keeps us from reincarnating more often, over and over again.
I know people who want to reincarnate more. I know people who actually have resisted this path by saying, but I want the experience. I want to be a male next time, or female, or I want to live in the year 2200, or I want,
Some people want to be a cat. Like
they're being deprived or something. I can't relate to that at all. I don't want to come back ever if I have any choice.
I know a lot of people like that. Most people I know really don't want to come back.
Don't want to. Yeah. Most people I know do want to.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In fact, they fear that they won't. Their idea of death is total annihilation. And that's why they're so afraid of it. You know, they think that's it.
But my greatest fear really is reincarnation. And when you look around and you see the way most babies are, the lives that they're born into, the parents that they're born to. I mean, that's true in hell.
Well, that's what I was saying. I don't want to be that's hell, and also, who cares? Who wants to be on the karmic wheel? I can't relate to that. I want to get off.
So jump off.
That's why I'm here. This is a diving board, Robert.
Yes.
I'm just...
I'm going to go dive in the bathroom.
Well, Robert, why do I have to ask myself this? Did Ramana give satsang per se?
No. He was just there.
He never gave satsang?
Yes.
He never used the word. Oh, he always asked the question.
He just asked directly. He asked questions.
But he never used the word satsang. Yeah. Because he was not into yoga or spiritual terminology.
Well, was there like a regular meeting time or anything like that?
There were regular times when you can see them.
And at that time, questions were asked.
He always lied on the couch. He slept on the couch, sat on the couch.
Those pictures.
Did everything on the couch. So when he slept, he would get up. His attendant would open the doors at 8 o'clock in the morning. And people would come in first. They'd have these Brahmins who would sing songs to them. And I just sit there nodding his head because they wanted approval. And then he would just sit around and people would ask questions. If he felt like answering, he would read the mail out loud and write something. All his activities were done in front of everybody except going to the bathroom.
What time were the doors closed?
They were closed between 12 and 2 for lunch. Open again between 3 and 7.
So it was like satsang all day long?
Yeah.
Basically.
Then about 7 he would take a walk.
And didn't people follow after him? Didn't you say they'd trail along?
And sure, and he'd try to follow.
So you used to sit there all day in his company?
Yeah.
All day?
Yeah.
And that was one way he talked about bestowing grace, like look.
He said this to people because they want to announce like that.
Yeah, because there's three traditional ways that someone actually transmits energy or whatever. But being in someone's presence like that is happening all the time or whatever it is.
It was very untraditional.
Through the eyes, through flesh, or through thought. I guess it's also verbal. Through mind.
All these people have thrown themselves down in front of the same. Because if you just happen to get a new car, get a new house, get a new wife, that was the only.
You're missing the point.
I would say you would look at it and say, yes, yes.